Hello, my name's Craig Barker, and I'm the head of public engagement at the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney. Welcome to Object Matters, the podcast in which we explore the relationship between our guests and museum collection items. For this episode, my guest is a classicist and archaeologist, and a friend of mine too, which makes it doubly special, Dr. Alina Kozlowski, who's going to be talking about her object from the collection. But before we get to that, Alina currently works in the curatorial department of the Santa Barbara Museum of Art in the United States of America, and will soon be the lecturer of digital innovation in ancient history and archaeology at the University of New England. Alina, thank you very much for joining us on Object Matters. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you, Craig. Thank you so much for inviting me to join you on the podcast.
So I guess before we talk about the object you've selected, let's begin by talking a bit about your own background, because of course you graduated from the University of Sydney, but what are your research interests and how are they pertinent to the object you selected today and your own relationship with the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection over the years?
Well, so, I mean, broadly speaking, yeah, as you said, I'm a classicist and archaeologist, so I study the Greek and Roman world, which I started at the University of Sydney and then continued in the UK, in Cambridge. My research interest, my PhD research was about how the Romans sort of constructed their own past using material things, right? So using sort of a lot of the debates that we have today about, like, okay, we have a lot of ancient Greek and Roman ruins, what do we do with them, right? Do we reconstruct them? Do we leave them be? Do we sort of preserve them in their current state, but then and not let them fall apart at all, or do we let them continue to become more ruinous and stuff like that? And a lot of these debates often are presented as a kind of fairly recent problem, but actually ancient Romans and Greeks also wandered around ruins, like literally wandered around ruins, and then also wrote about them and depicted them in images and thought about what do we do with ancient stuff, because they were discovering the ancient stuff of their own time. And then so I looked at that, and I looked at what they thought about when do you rebuild a building, when you rebuild a historic building, how do you make it look, and that sort of thing. So I'm broadly sort of interested in how society and culture creates the past using physical things, because, you know, texts, they tell stories, and they have the voices of ancient people, but objects, they actually give the past a look, right? They make it visual. And then so my actual academic research then tied in very well with me working in museums for a number of years across a few different countries, where museums are sort of like the front lines of making the past look like something, right? Because they put things on display and they make very specific choices about how that's done. And then I ended up also, because I worked in a museum of copies in Cambridge, I got interested in the history of plaster casts, which is why then I kind of retrospectively got interested in the casts at the Nicholson, where I used to work as an undergraduate and a master's student with you.
Yes. Oh, so this is the beginning of your relationship with the Chow Chak Wing Collection, was being part of the school education team back in the old days of the Nicholson Museum, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, my actual the beginning of the relationship started in high school, because in year 11 I came on a school excursion and I did one of the education programs. I still remember the object that I drew and wrote about in the hands-on room, which was one of the Shabti, which is an ancient Egyptian object. And yeah, and then, you know, a few years later, I was a undergraduate and master's student then running these programs with the wonderful team with you. And yeah, so I worked there for about 6 years, and then I moved to the UK, so I started working at other museums as well.
That's interesting, really pertinent to the object you've selected, which we'll come to in a moment, but this idea of using replicas and casts and so on, both in teaching but also in research, and you talked about the experiences in Cambridge. Does the Santa Barbara collection have casts as well as a matter of interest, or are they only genuine original objects?
No, we don't have any casts. No, we do have ancient objects of which there are casts in other collections. At least one, basically, I found, because we have a very famous Hermes.
Yes.
Just like the Chow Chak Wing has a famous Hermes.
Yes.
And yeah, there is a cast of that, at least one of them, but the actual collection itself does not have any.
But it's interesting that throughout your career, that duality between archaeological objects in their original form and then casts or copies or replicas of those being used both for education and also research, that you're seeing it both here in Sydney and in Cambridge as well. Did you find that interesting, that those parallels, that as you're going along, that plaster casts were following you?
Oh, absolutely. Because they're literally the same ones, right? Because they're copies of the same object.
Original.
So you're kind of like, oh, I used to stand next to this same object. I mean, it's not the same actual object, but it's a copy of the same object back in Sydney. And now I'm in Cambridge and doing the same thing. Yeah. And then also, actually, I mean, Australia has lots of collections of plaster casts. And since coming back to Australia, I've also studied a very big collection of plaster casts at the Powerhouse Museum. Those ones are mostly not of Greek and Roman stuff. But again, like, yeah, you know, I lived in Europe for a long time. And then now you know, seeing original objects and casts there, and now there's casts here and original objects. You know, it's all a nice network of interrelationships.
Well, we'll talk about casts in the Australian context a little bit later on, but I guess I should ask you, obviously you've chosen a cast, but for the episode today, which particular item from the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection have you chosen to discuss?
So I've chosen a plaster cast of an object called the Boston Throne. And although I think, yeah, I mean, we're going to be mostly talking about the value of the casts and the copies and the as copies, it is important to actually also talk about the originals they come from. So the original object is an object that is in the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. And it was found in the late 19th century. And then it ended up in Rome. And then it ended up in England for a while. And then it was bought by this museum. So it's been in Boston for over a century. And I've chosen it because, I mean, first of all, I wanted to choose a plaster cast because, you know, it's a topic that interests me. But also this one was in the education room at the Nicholson when I used to work there. So, I mean, I've stood next to this object so many, like, you know, because the casts were, because they've been sort of treated differently to other museum objects throughout their history, this wasn't in a glass case or anything like that. It was just sort of sitting in the education room, and I used to literally just stand really close to it. And yeah, I just remember it really well. It was, you know, part of the sort of everyday experience of my working at the Nicholson. So that's why I've chosen.
It's interesting, isn't it? For something that we've both spent so much time with, to sort of what you pick up by osmosis. I wonder if you could describe both the cast and obviously the original Boston Throne, you know, that if any of our listeners have been to the United States and have had a chance to visit the Museum of Fine Arts may have seen it, but could you actually describe what it looks like?
So it's quite a large object. It's basically a three-panel relief. So there's like one big panel and then there's two that kind of come off perpendicularly on either side. I looked at the dimensions. I mean, it's quite large. It's like about 160 centimeters by I think 80 centimeters or so. Yeah. So, I mean, I remember standing next to it. It's quite large.
Yes.
So it has one scene and sort of two images. So the main scene has three figures on it. It has two women or two female figures, and on either side, and in the center there is a male figure with wings. And then on the side panels, there are also two figures. There's on one side, there is a female figure. Again, don't know if they're human or not. And then on the other side, there is a male figure with a lyre. And they are kind of ambiguous about their meaning. So there's been different interpretations about who they are. And actually, interestingly, because I was looking up some information about this in preparation for this, and there's differences in connection to how they've been described by the Nicholson Museum in the past and how they are described now in Boston. So on their website, they talk about the figures being, on the main panel, being Aphrodite, the goddess Aphrodite, the goddess of love, and the goddess Demeter, with Eros, or Cupid, in the center. And then there's this catalogue of plaster casts from the Nicholson collection from the 40s, where A.D. Trendall describes them as youth, age, and Eros. So there's differences in opinion about what it actually represents. It's quite interesting because there's also, so the original object was made of stone and it has these slits in it, horizontal slits across the torso and wings of Eros, which would have originally probably been actually sort of had metal bits attached, which would have been the shape of a scale. So he's weighing something. But the metal bits in ancient sculpture had metal bits attached all the time. But over time, those would have been ripped off and remelted into something else. So that what were often left was these holes. But with the plaster casts, right, the cast was made after the metal was removed. So there's sort of the holes were created there because it's sort of the replica of the original, but the metal was, you know, never had any contact with it or anything like that. And there's different interpretations as to why Eros is, or Cupid is in the center, sort of weighing something. Again, you can go, there's many articles written about this.
Yes. There's been a lot of literature on them on this scene over the years, hasn't there? I mean, it's interesting, described as a throne, but of course these large stone, you know, marble cut blocks, and there's not just the one we're talking about today, but there's also quite famously the Ludovisi throne. And I always look at them and go, that's not at all what I thought a throne should look like in terms of a seat as such. Do we know what they were being used for, these relief panels?
In ancient times? I mean, the theory is maybe it's part of some kind of an altar. I'm not actually sure of the history of why they ended up being called a throne, apart from just the shape, because they're kind of like the C shape now. But yeah, I mean, partially it's an issue of also of we don't know if they're actually ancient, right? But one of the theories is that, yeah, it might have been some sort of Greek religious structure. And then they at some point got brought to Rome, and where they were found was in allient times the Gardens of Sallust, which was this great garden complex owned by the writer Sallust and previously owned by Julius Caesar. And these really, you know, famous and wealthy Romans used to like to collect Greek sculpture and put it on display. So, I mean, it would fit that story quite well. So basically it might have originated as in a religious context, but then ended up in a sort of display context, where Romans were displaying the wealth of their empire, essentially. That's if it's ancient. I wrote about how there's a theory that it might have been just an ancient basin, and then it got recarved in the 19th century to add the figures. So it might be an original ancient object recarved in the 19th century. Now we have a copy. So it's in it.
Well, man, look, it's interesting. Let us for the rest of the podcast assume that the one in Boston, the stone one, is a genuine ancient object. But in itself, that object has a fascinating object history in that it's a Greek object, been taken to Rome, been rediscovered, gone through Europe, and has now ended up in the United States. But now there's that added complexity, because what we're actually looking at is not the original object, but here in Australia, a cast, one of many casts that have been made, that then extends the life of the object, if that makes sense, because it's a complete facsimile of the original. You know, and we're well aware of copies and in antiquity as well of marble and bronze statues being remade in marble. But I guess on a broader, more philosophical level, why is it important for us to use modern copies to understand ancient art and to enhance our understanding of modern perceptions of ancient art as well? What's the role of a copy in a broader archaeological context?
Well, I mean, copies are everywhere, right? I mean, if you think about, you can have copies of form. So this is the case with these plaster casts, because they are casts made from molds from the original objects. Sometimes they are casts made from casts made from casts. So sort of the direct engagement with the original is actually many steps behind. But even if you think about, like, what is a photo, right? That's also a copy. Like, most of the time when we look at objects, when we're studying the ancient world, we are looking at a surrogate in some sense. So, you know, not everyone can afford to go to Greece or to Boston or Italy. So these objects have played a very important role in sort of the transmission of information about what these objects actually look like. And they obviously add things that photos can't show, because they show you the size, they show you the form. Like where I worked in Cambridge, in the museum there, it was quite fascinating to walk through the sort of landscape of bodies from the ancient world. And they're all copies, like the actual original objects are in heaps of different museums around the world. Here you can kind of combine them into one. And for better or for worse, I mean, they do usually get displayed sort of in a chronological way, so you can kind of walk through history in some sense. And you know, all of this is all, I study the constructions of the past, it's all very much a construction. But it does give you, I think, a particular perspective to be able to sort of see a physical object, even if it's not the sort of the original object. It was really beneficial. Like, I used to teach undergraduates there, and it was great to be able to sort of walk among the casts, even from a, like I said, a personal perspective. Like, these are human, I mean, sometimes they're divine bodies, but they're bodies, you know, you have your own body, so you can kind of compare, and then you can think about what sort of bodies are represented and which ones aren't, and how, do you fit into that? What does you or we mean when we talk about all this? So they're interesting in that sense. And I think obviously there's modern iterations of copies today as well. We have, you know, 3D printing and all that sort of stuff. So all this stuff has a long history going back to antiquity, and it's still continuing. And some people can be quite dismissive, they will say, you know, I don't want to, let's go to a museum full of copies. That's what we used to get asked all the time. Are these real? Like, why do you even have copies on display? And these debates have been in museums for 200 years about whether museums should have copies or not. But yeah, I mean, I certainly think that there's value to them. But I mean, yeah, they can tell the story of the ancient world, and they can tell a separate story as well of more recent sort of ideas about art and history and so forth.
Well, look, I'm really pleased you raised that point about the history of museums and museology as well, because there's been that really interesting, almost circular ideology about casts and replicas that in the late 19th and early 20th century, which is predominantly what we're dealing with the Nicholson collection anyway, but right across Europe, that sense of it was perfectly fine to display casts alongside genuine objects. Then you kind of had a period of purity where replicas were not allowed anywhere near the treasures of the ancient world. And we've resumed an era. And again, dioramas fit into this as well too, don't they? And corkboard models and cast models and things as well. But I think the 21st century realized the actual value of these as objects in their own right. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's quite sick. It's been very cyclical, this whole thing, because you can kind of make it, because yeah, the usual sort of history of it is kind of like people really like casts, then people hate casts, and now people like casts again. I mean, it's always actually been very complicated. So even in the periods that usually get represented as they liked casts, there are also people who hated casts then too. In the 19th century, there was definitely a big move and sort of quite a big theoretical debate about the role of things like mechanical reproduction. And art and the role of the artist when you can just make lots of copies of something, right? And so, yeah, and they were also, even at that time, we talk about plaster casts a lot, but they also were making copies of paintings.
Yes.
All over the place and sending them all around the world. So this is also the era when photography was invented. So, you know, you also, yeah, again, get this other version of a type of surrogate you can create for an object. Yeah. I mean, if not in its form, or at least its image. So, yeah, and yeah, so in the 20th century, similarly, I mean, there's been definitely people who have hated their existence. There's people who have really liked them. Obviously, as someone who used to work in a cast gallery, I think they're very useful because they do provide lots of opportunities to think about different stories to what you can think about than the originals. Mm. And sometimes they've been able to, because although they are accession museum objects, often they've been sort of, you've been allowed to do more with them than you might be with an ancient object. Even though in many cases they're actually more fragile than the original.
Yes, it's an interesting paradox.
Plastic is more fragile than marble. So.
Yeah, the marble originals that have survived for more than two millennia, but then the casts themselves we have examples in this collection that were broken for whatever reason. You're right. That fragility is quite important, isn't it? Yeah, taking us back to the late 19th and early 20th century, and that concept of surrogacy that feeds in with photography being developed around the same time as well. But, particularly within an Australian context, was the concept of using casts, the ability to enable access to the originals at a time when it's not possible to travel as easily? Is that the rationale behind them?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's part of a 19th century sort of, in Europe, democratization of knowledge. That's how it's sort of presented. I mean, you can have a lot of arguments about who or what kind of knowledge was being presented. But yeah, I mean, if originally the originals were, kept in particular, either big sort of the Pope's collection, or it might be a wealthy aristocrat's house or something like that, which obviously had very limited access. And then other aristocrats decided to make plaster copies, and then we get these public museums that start collecting them. And then they also start being sent around the world. So, you know, there's this super colonial thing of trying to educate the, Australians about the great masterpieces of the ancient world, the ancient Greco-Roman world. Mm. And so the casts were brought to Australia. And I mean, there are, I think, some so elements of interesting conversations that were had about the role of also Australian and also New Zealand indigenous art and how to display it with among these casts, right?
Yep.
So these are conversations I think would have been quite, were definitely more important here than like in the UK or something like that.
Yeah.
And this sort of stuff, this is what I mean, and it actually goes back quite a long way. And this is what I mean by the copies kind of create opportunities for conversations that the originals, I mean, the conversation could still be there if you brought the ancient sculpture here.
Yep.
From Greece, or I mean, we obviously have some ancient Greek and Roman sculptures in Australia too, but I think the conversation's slightly different.
Yep.
So they got brought to Australia and then ended up in various collections, and then some of these have been dispersed, so now a lot of schools apparently have casts in Australia. But it is, yeah, it's definitely very much part of this sort of imperialist ethic, let's say, of bringing European culture elsewhere and sort of and making a canon of the great works, right? So because this idea of like what you create a copy of then ends up being important, right? So the things that didn't get copies created of them,
yes,
are much more forgotten because they weren't featured in other museums' collections as copies, so they didn't end up in textbooks and things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Australia was part of the sort of broader network of like deciding or continuing this idea of, you know, the Laocoon is really, that's a famous sculpture from Rome, is a really famous sculpture, partially because we have so many copies of it, so everyone has seen it, or lots of people have seen it.
I mean, it's interesting interesting, not just your experience with the University of Sydney's collections, but the powerhouse as well. But within the Australian context, are they almost always exclusively European objects that are being cast? Or was there periodically something from Asia or from Africa that also got cast?
Yeah, absolutely. This is actually something that doesn't, I mean, people obviously do know about it, doesn't get talked about as much though. But yes, absolutely. They did make casts in Europe of objects from Asia and also from the Americas. I'm not sure about other places in the world, but it's entirely possible. But definitely, we do have English and other European collectors from the 19th and late 18th century who are very interested in also art from around the world. So it's not entirely just Greek. I think the Greek and Roman stuff is more common, but there's definitely collections. Like, I mean, I've been looking at online collections of cast galleries from around the world a lot. And yeah, they often do actually include some objects from, you know, India or from somewhere like Mexico, and so then copies of them. So there's, for example, in Harvard, there's a museum, I think it's the Peabody Museum of Anthropology. They have a whole lot of casts. I think they're from Mexico.
Yeah, right.
So cast of objects from Mexico. So yeah, so absolutely. Yeah, there were casts created of other cultures too. And also different periods, because, for example, yeah, the Powerhouse collection of casts of over 600 plaster casts that they have at the Powerhouse are mostly medieval and Byzantine objects, so not Greek and Roman.
You're listening to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. So, Alina, how old was both the original Boston Throne and how old is our Sydney plaster cast copy?
Okay, well, we're going back to the story of authenticity again, because the Boston Throne, depending on which article you read, it might be from the 5th century BCE, Greece, or at least Greek world, could be from Sicily, or it could be Roman imperial, or it could be 19th century, so... and I think that's actually an important, the fact that it could be a copy, the Nicholson, so the Chow Chak Wing object could be a copy of a forgery, actually, I think makes it even more interesting as a copy. And then the cast in the Chow Chak Wing Museum, I guess, would have been brought in the early 20th century. That's when casts were put into the, accessioned into the collection, or I don't know if they're actually properly accessioned, but they were brought into the collection of the Nicholson Museum at the time. So was it the 1920s, I think, or something like that?
It seems likely. I mean, we don't have a precise date. This one, of course, was officially accessioned into the collection in 2008, but has been around for much, much longer than that. It was one of the curators of the old Nicholson Museum and the then professor of Greek, William Woodhouse. Some of our listeners will be aware of the Woodhouse Photographic Archives as well, that has been the subject of much research by my colleagues here at the museum. But Woodhouse very much expanded the museum's cast collection, and it was quite a sizable one. As you mentioned, in 1941, there was even a guidebook to the cast collection published before a guidebook to the actual Nicholson Museum had been published, actually. So that was interesting in terms of the size of it. Just to go back to your previous point, too, really interesting observation about the original Boston Throne, the fact that whether it's Greek or Roman or indeed modern as an original object, but also shows some of the complexities in terms of trying to understand material archaeologically and how without proper context, often it's very difficult to have any certainty, isn't it?
Well, I mean, but that's the interesting thing, though, right? The claim is that it does have proper context, that it came from the Gardens of Sallust, right? So what was at the time was I think it's called the Ludovisi Park in the 19th century. So it's more so how context gets recorded,
And manipulated.
So if it actually was on display at the Gardens of Sallust, that's amazing. But that's also not its technically original context, because it might have been brought from Greece, right? So these objects had lives before they ended up in the soil for us to find. So it's very complicated.
Now, the technique of casting, because I know you've done some investigation into this over the course of your research, how would have a cast such as the Boston Throne one, presumably it's been cast in Boston and then been sent out to Australia and other institutions around the globe, but how would have they made a cast in the first place?
Well, I mean, it's the process of creating a mold, essentially. So you're pouring plaster over the original. Originally, you're allowed to do this. You're allowed to pour the plaster over the original object. And then you kind of, you wait for that to set and you sort of take it off. And so you create this mold, which has the cavity that's in the shape of the original object, and then that's your mold to create a copy, right? So you're pouring plaster into your plaster mold. Though it's, I think it's quite interesting, though, in terms of this making process and stuff, again, because in the 19th century, there was this whole thing about mechanical reproduction and all this sort of stuff. A lot of the sort of people that were making these kind of get cast as not artists, I guess, because it seems like it's just mass production at this point, right? Yeah. But if you actually look at lots of cast collections, if you get to see a lot of these casts that were made then en masse, you can see a massive variety in quality. Yeah. So they are also works of art in their own right, because what I just described is a really simple process. It's actually more complicated. Like, often they were made in pieces, so you had to stick the pieces together, and then you had to finish the surface. So, because, you know, it can be quite sort of bumpy and stuff like that, and they would have to polish it and stuff like that. The ones in Cambridge, in the museum where I worked, in the Museum of Classical Archaeology, I mean, a lot of them were actually even painted to look like marble.
Yeah.
So, you know, they're very confusing when you see them, because they look like stone. And then we had a really recently made one, which was not painted. They could see a massive difference. We also there had plaster casts made of original bronze objects, which were then painted to look like bronze, which, I mean, I can't tell you how many times people would come into the museum and be like, oh, so it's all made of plaster, right? Apart from those bronze ones. I'm like, no, they're also made of plaster. We've just fooled you, right? So they actually have a really great video on the website, because one of the plaster bronzes was painted in the 2010s sometime. So there's actually a YouTube video of it being done. So you
fantastic.
Can see. So, I mean, they're actually sort of artistic objects in their own right. And again, you can bring up the conversation of, like, what is the role of the artist? Like, what does an artist do, right? Yeah. Like, the original object was created by an ancient person, but then there's these modern people who are making them as well. Yeah.
Now, it's interesting you talk about the colouring of the casts as well with the marble, because, of course, there is, and I'm sure most of our listeners are very aware of this, but there's been much discussion in recent years about the racial elements of the study of classics and the way that often aspects of classical culture have been adopted by the far right in many ways, and a lot of assumptions by many people about the racial makeup of the classical world and so on that have often been pointed at white statues. And obviously marble itself was white, although we all know that in many cases in the classical world that marble sculptures were of course coloured. But the fact that most, not all, but most casts that were made were white or were painted to look like white marble, do you think that's also had an impact upon popular perceptions of how Greeks and Romans would have looked?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is what I mean. We're talking about the dissemination of information about the ancient world through these copies, right? So it's interesting how had the plaster naturally been a different color, things might have worked out completely differently. But because the plaster is white, so the sculpture has mostly been white, it's perpetuated what was originally perpetuated by the white marble. We've got cases where the ancient sculpture does have some colours remaining on it, so that's how we know that, of course, they used to paint at least some of them, we know. Of course, we don't know exactly what the process was, or, like, if you made a marble sculpture and then you painted it and then it stood in a town square or a temple for 100 years, would you repaint it? If you repainted it, would you repaint it a different color? You know, so, or would you leave it to flake to show its antiquity or anything like that? And then, so the plaster casts have mostly been white, or they've been painted to look like the ancient sculpture whose color has fallen off.
Yes.
Or they've been repainted because people were more comfortable with altering the casts. They've sometimes been painted really bright colors to try and reconstruct how the ancient sculpture might have originally looked.
Yes.
But again, I mean, a lot of, these are, you know, studies based off usually fragments of color, but not always. So sometimes you do have these examples that we're not entirely sure what the sort of color reconstruction was based off. But I mean, it's mostly to sort of give you an impression, right?
Yeah.
So the impression that the ancient world was actually very colorful. Color was expensive, so of course you're going to paint your sculptures.
Yes.
And then now the color on the casts is also sometimes coming off because the casts are old, so they're having their own histories of flaking polychromy, just like the marble sculpture.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, if the casts themselves are, the Boston Throne is a good example that it is at least 100 years old, so they've taken on quite a fair bit of antiquity themselves in their own right. So Again, from a collection care perspective, there's also an interesting question of how many resources or how much time and effort do you put into preserving the replicas as opposed to the care that goes into collecting originals?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, something that I've been interested in is even how you also like record casts, because they have, you end up with this sort of double history, right? Because you always kind of record the history of the actual object and you record the history of the original that it's based on. And just in a museum database, that's actually really annoying. So, as you can see sometimes on these museum websites as well, like it's actually quite confusing what they're talking about. True. Or on a museum label where you have even less space, right? So you might be already saying it's a Roman copy of a Greek original, but now you're saying it's a 19th century copy of a Roman copy of a Greek original. And if you don't know much about the Greco-Roman world or about this whole thing of making plaster casts in the 19th, 20th centuries, then you know, that's very confusing.
It's very confusing, isn't it? Yeah.
I want to actually briefly discuss this whole idea of having a cast of a forgery, right? Because I think it's actually really interesting, because it's kind of within their own existence, right? Their own sort of ontology, these casts work in relationship with something else, right? Because they are copies of another object. And then so they're always kind of, when they're just a copy of an ancient object, they're always kind of seen as lesser than the original. When you have an original that might be a forgery, right, and then your cast kind of ends up being a bit more authentic than the original, because the original was made with the intent to lie to the viewer, yes, while the cast was just a cast, right? No one ever pretended it was sort of real, in inverted commas. So I think, yeah, like when I was in Cambridge, I did this little display where in the cast gallery, I put forgeries on display, like objects that we've been decided to be forgeries. So first of all, that made the casts kind of seem more real.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Because they weren't lies like the forgeries were. And then we also had copies of potential forgeries. So where your copy kind of ends up being more authentic than the original. That's really sort of getting really philosophical, but I think that's actually really interesting. Which actually, yeah, when I was looking at, you know, which cast to select for today, that's one of the reasons I picked this one. Because this extra sort of layer of complication about the relationship between objects, whether they're in a museum collection or even in a museum on a museum floor, because I can tell you people react differently when you put forgeries next to casts.
Yeah, that's a fascinating observation, isn't it? And that whole ambiguity. I mean, it's also really interesting to, again, maybe it's because of our background as archaeologists, there's a certain degree of logic you would assume in making a cast of a genuine, quote-unquote, ancient object to distribute to museums for people who are not going to be able to see the original for whatever reason. But to make a completely accurate copy of something which was manufactured only a decade before sounds quite obscene when you think about it like that, or, you know, just very obtuse as a concept. But I guess if you're passing that off as being a genuine object, then it takes on those extra dimensions, doesn't it? But it's really unpeeling those layers again.
I mean, try to put plaster cast copy of a forgery of an ancient Roman copy of a Greek object on a museum label. Right, it gets very, complicated. But I mean, like I said, I mean, the point is that, like, you know, you can start very interesting conversations, right, about what you think. What are the parameters of authenticity?
Yeah.
Right, so do we value the intent of the creator? Do we value, you know, whether it was actually made by ancient hands? You know, some people in the 19th century actually argued that plaster casts were better than the originals, yes, because they allowed you to focus on form,
yes,
and not be distracted by surface, right, distracted by the dirt of the ages and stuff like that. So what is authentic, right? So, and I think copies are, you know, wonderful for starting these, I mean, continuing these conversations, because these conversations have happened since antiquity.
Can that also be dependent upon the perspective of the viewer, that if you're approaching the object as an art historical object in the broader sense of art history, so capturing the spirit of the movement or the culture that's producing it, so actually having a cast captures all of that without you necessarily needing it, whereas if you're coming up from a historical or archaeological perspective where you're wanting the truth, quote unquote, does that bring, again, adding those layers of complexity, that the same object can take on different meanings depending upon the types of questions you're asking of it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's so important for the history of our discipline as well, because, I mean, even if you look, like, I studied at a few different universities, and you can see the same material is presented differently because of their different histories, or there's a very art, you know, archaeological perspective from one side, and then there's a very art historical perspective from the other side. And, yeah, so, I mean, a historian could, like I said, I mean, the you know, cast have their own lives and stories as well, so they can be the historical artifacts in their own right, even if, you know, they weren't made by ancient hands or anything like that, but they might have been made by hands from 150 years ago, so they're historical objects. Well, yeah, art historian should probably be interested in surface today too, but it's a different perspectives, so lead to different stories.
Now, we've already discussed about how the cast have followed you around your career, and I hope that when you get to Armidale soon that there are some casts up there for you to play with as well. But I guess bringing it back to the Boston Frone cast here in the University of Sydney in particular, what meaning does it have for you personally?
Well, for me personally, very personally, like, it really reminds me of a really nice time in my life when, I'm kind of, you know, preaching to the choir here, but when I used to work at the Nicholson Museum, it was such a, you know, this was my beginnings in archaeology. It was the first museum, I think it was the first museum I ever worked in. And yeah, that object was always there in the education room. So there are a few other casts there, but that's the one I used to stand next to. So, because we didn't have a copy of it in Cambridge, but yeah, because of the forgery story, I mean, that definitely connects me to my time there, because that's the stuff I was researching there. And yeah, now it's in the US where I also worked and currently work, so we kind of connect everything, right? So
it's interesting, isn't it? It's the cast that's following you, not the actual Boston Front.
Well, that's the point. Networks around the world.
Networks. Networks. Yeah, and again, that 19th and early 20th century idea of trading of ideas and visualization of ideas, isn't it? It really is networked. Now, the question everyone who appears on Object Matters gets asked is the question about if you could choose one word to represent how the cast signifies meaning for you, what's the word that you would choose?
I would choose the word opportunity, which I've mentioned many times, because I think it's easy to kind of dismiss copies and sort of focus on the hand of the original hand of the artist or whatever else, but there's so many other artists and people involved in their creation. They tell so many stories. They sometimes tell stories that are kind of newer and more interesting, I think, than even the originals. So I think opportunity is a good word.
It's an excellent word. Thank you very much for that. That really is an excellent word. I guess the final thing I'd like to ask, now, unfortunately, this particular cast is not on public display at the moment, although some of our other casts in the collections are accessible and available. But if any of our listeners ever had the opportunity to actually see the Boston Frone cast, whether it's ours in Sydney or another one in a different museum around the world, what would you like them to stop and think about while they're looking at it?
Well, everything I just said, basically. So, well, yeah, I mean, like I said, think about for what it is the surrogate for. So think about the potentially ancient object or the forgery, but also think about the object itself and its history. I mean, I don't know, wherever it might be on display, it depends on how much history is kind of given in the label or whatever, but, you know, these objects have their own lives, and, you know, these lives will continue. Like, we don't know what's going to happen to these cast collections in the next century or two centuries or whatever. So, and, you know, as we also create so many copies today as well through the digital and 3D printing and all this sort of stuff, you know, this is just one step of a long, long ancient history of copying.
Yes.
Basically, please don't dismiss it.
No.
So, as a fake, it's fake or whatever. Yeah, copies have their own interesting value.
Thank you, Alina. I think you've given us a lot to think about with that, and I know I certainly will look at it again. Again, like you, have spent a lot of time standing next to the Boston Frone cast. To place it in a context like this has been fantastic. So, thank you. Thank you for all the years you worked with us with the education team as well. Listeners, Alina has been one of the best teachers we've had. We've had school students and school teachers over the years say how great she was. So best of luck up in Armidale with your new role. And thank you very much for appearing on Object Matters, Alina.
Thank you so much for inviting me and for this very kind words. I will keep those forever, Craig.
Thank you. Object Matters is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The University of Sydney and the Chow Chak Wing Museum acknowledges the traditional custodians of the lands, and we pay our respect to elders past, present and future.
Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chow Chak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, News Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.